You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections. I'm Alan Collier again, and being the second Wednesday of the month, it's our legal hour. And just a reminder that, well, you must know by now, the legal hour now is on a between one and twos to give the boys and the ladies a bit more time to get here. So I have with me from Hutchin Legal, Andrew and Matthew. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having us.
Not a problem. Now, we sent, I think it was Madeleine and whoever it was last time away, we've had a question about parole. Now, sometimes a judge will give a term, maybe 10 years, and sometimes with a non-parole period of 5, or sometimes maybe not. It's just a term. Well, the question, well, there's two or three questions there. First of all, what does the prisoner have to do when the 5 years automatically, if it was a 10-year with a 5-year non-parole, do they automatically get considered for parole or do they have to apply for it? Secondly, if they do apply for it, what does the judge have to take into account before they decide whether they have parole or not? Or is it a parole board? We don't know. You're going to tell us. Or if there is no non-parole period, or if the judge says it's, or the crook decides, no, I don't want a parole, I want to go the full term for some reason, what happens then? Do the doors just open and they walk out? Please tell us, gentlemen.
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and a number of questions there. The first one being, if there's no application that's actually made, then no parole will be granted automatically. So if you're serving a 10-year sentence and you've got a 5-year non-parole period, then 12 months before that 5 years, so in the fourth year of that you're in prison, you'd have to make an application. Now, there's a couple of steps that you have to go to do that, but ultimately that application comes before a parole board. Depending on the nature of the crime, it may be one person, it could be a combination of people. If it's a serious crime, well, in that case, you'd have a full board that's reviewing the decision.
Well, can I just ask you, what's a full board? How many?
So, it depends. So, you have different sizes that are based on the nature of the crime. You have serious violent, what they call a SVOSO, and that board is for serious violent offences or sexual offences. Now, you'd have different members on that board depending on the crime. And again, the paramount consideration that they would have is the safety of the public. So whether or not somebody should be released on parole is not necessarily just given once they've hit their 5-year period. So
they need to apply for it, but they also can't just be guaranteed because the judge said a non-parole period of 5 years.
That's right.
Right. Yep.
So if they've got a 5-year period, they need to apply. Usually that'll be on the fourth year. And there are a bunch of assessments that take place. They go before, well, the prisoner has to make what's called a parole application form. That form is then reviewed by the case manager. This all happens within the prison itself. The case manager prepares another report, and that goes before the board. And the board then orders or requests, if they think it's appropriate, for what's called a parole suitability assessment. Now, that's the juicy report that considers everything that you'd think that they would. So it considers things like accommodation, the victim's statements, or if there are any affected family members that have been affected by the crime, they'd have an opportunity to have their say. That'll all be taken into consideration by the board.
All right, so what happens, we'll say the judge gave the person 5 years non-parole period. For some reason, the criminal decides to go the full 10 years. At the end of the 10 years, the full sentence has been served. Do they just fling the doors open and say, well, go, out you go, or is there assessment made on a prisoner before they're allowed out? And can they keep them after the 10 years, I guess?
Well, that's a good question. It's a distinct one from parole. Yep. The short answer is that just because there's a non-parole period, doesn't mean that the parole will automatically be granted. At the end of a sentence, what would ordinarily happen at the end of that sentence would still go ahead. So if that is to mean that the doors are open, then that's what would happen. But again, I would assume it depends on what happens on a case-by-case basis.
Now, what I'm getting at, though, like the prisoner doesn't have to make application or anything like to that at that time. They just and there's no restrictions on them. They're just allowed out the door once their 10 years is done. Am I right on that or am I wrong?
No, that's right. If it's the end of the sentence, then yep. it's the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
So there, I don't believe there are any other applications that need to be made. But again, if there is any sort of extenuating circumstances that apply to a particular case, then you may there would be a case-by-case basis.
Beauty. All right, we'll just take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
James Bundle touring show. So you pulled up in your Ray-Bans, Riverina dirt on your jeans. We rehearsed it down Fig Street and hit the road. Back in 92, it was all brand new. It was girls and guitars and hotel. Every night. All right, there was smoke in the air. It was sellout shows. It was way out west, cranking on the radio. Whoa, back in 92. Well, they came backstage and nearly trashed the place at the Wee War Bowling Club. Yeah, and we stopped singing, our ears were ringing, 'cause the party never stopped. They say this road goes on forever, but all good things must end. Yeah, you fired my ass back in Sydney, now we're back again.
Listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to Community Connections with the boys from Hutchison Legal. Now, these two guys in particular do a lot of work in the family law department, so we'll be talking a bit about family law. We do have another question, or quite a complex question to send them away with, so they'll probably be glad to pass it on to someone else. But, Andrew, you want to talk a little bit about parenting arrangements prior to or during separation?
Yes, yeah, thanks, Alan. Yeah, it's a topic that's of more and more relevance to people, as you know, separation is quite common, and the children often get caught in the midst of it. So we thought it might be useful for the listeners to hear a little bit about how things work from a legal point of view in terms of the kids. Obviously, once people separate, there needs to be some sort of arrangement put in place for the children, and
they're the ones that suffer the most.
That's right. Yeah,
adults can do something about it. The children children have got no say.
That's exactly right, and yet they also they suffer the most as well. They get caught in the crossfire. Sometimes parents can lose sight of the kids and use them as a means to get back at the other one or to try and get some financial advantage, things like that. But the children always suffer, and it's a matter of trying to minimise the suffering and make it as best as possible for the kids. What a lot of people don't realise is that it's, from a legal point of view, it's the children that have all the rights. The parents don't actually have any rights. I often say to clients, no, that's right. Clients are always amazed when I tell them, you know, you don't have any rights. The parents get the responsibilities and the obligations, but it's the children that have the rights. And so the law is certainly on the side of children, and it's about trying to find an arrangement that works best for the kids in any particular circumstance. So it doesn't matter if you're mum, doesn't matter if you're dad, whoever you are, it's all about the kids, which is how it should be.
At one stage, the Howard government, I don't want to get into politics, but they had co-parenting. That doesn't still exist, does it, where it used to have to be 50-50?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, Alan, because it's actually before Parliament at the moment. They're seeking to make some amendments. The co-parenting is still in the legislation. The starting point, if a matter goes before a judge, in most circumstances, is to consider equal time, that the kids live with mum and dad on it. Technically, that's the starting point. Well, legally, that is the starting point. But in reality, it's rarely, if ever, thought to be in the best interests of the children for various reasons, and so lots of people do get confused because they think they've got a right to, you know, 50-50 with the kids because that's what the legislation says. But in reality, the best interest is always the overriding consideration, and it's a rare case where 50-50 is actually best for the children. Yeah,
because that was the idea of that legislation originally, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, that's right. But the study, social science, tells us that equal time generally only works best when the parents get along really well. There's got to be no conflict. They have to live nearby, live near the school. They have to parent in a very similar way. And it's just, it's an unusual case where all those factors apply. It's usually best for kids to live with one parent primarily and then sort of spend as much time as possible with the other parent, but not usually on an equal basis.
Well, in your experience over the years that you've been involved in and you're working all the time, is it appears that women tend to get the children more? Is that just a conception from outside, or is that reality?
Yeah, no, it's certainly true, and it's particularly because with very young children, the social science tells us that particularly preschool age children, that they need to be with their primary carer, which is almost invariably the mother, just for biological, you know, natural reasons. And so developmentally, if children are away from the primary carer, it's not that the other parent's not a good parent, but the children with their brain development can't cope if they're, you know, they don't understand that they'll see mum in 2 days' time or 3 days' time. And so the studies show that what's best for children with their development is to be with, usually it's the mum most of the time, and even up until the age of two, you usually wouldn't expect to see any regular overnight time with the dad. No. And then from sort of two to three, you might start to introduce the occasional night here and there and build it up. Studies show that even when parents get along really well and they agree on some sort of equal arrangement, that the children actually suffer. So even when parents agree on it, it doesn't mean it's best for the kids. So that's why typically with very young children, they are with mum most of the time, because that's, you know, scientifically, that's what's best for them. And dad just has to be patient and maximise as much time as he can with the kids and develop that secondary attachment. Once they're in school age, it changes a little bit. So usually sort of 5-6 years of age onwards, you can work towards something more of an equal care arrangement. But often by that stage, if it's a typical scenario where, you know, dad's working more than mum and mum's practically able to take care of the kids more, drop them to school, pick them up, stuff like that, then often it is best for them to be with that parent most of the time. So it depends on the arrangements.
I don't want to have a go at people, because we're not here to do that. We often hear them talk about deadbeat dads, but I'm going to open up a bit. Do you very often, in your experience, and I'm only talking about experience now, do you often get what you'd call a deadbeat mum, a mum where the court just says, I don't think this is going to work. Like, the children shouldn't be with this mum.
Yeah, it's a good question, Alan. And look, it certainly does happen. It's a rare case, though, for particularly if the kids, if mum's been the primary carer, mum has to be pretty in a pretty tricky situation for the court to change the primary care of the kids, because it's so upsetting to the children. Yeah. In the midst of a separation, stability and certainty and all of that's really important. So the cases where that would happen is usually where there's some sort of substance abuse. If mum's addicted to drugs, or we see a lot of alcohol. Alcohol's a massive problem. I've certainly had cases where mum hasn't been able to overcome an addiction to alcohol, and the kids have gone to be with dad. Or if there's serious mental health problems, then that can be an issue. The other one is where there's alienation. So if mum is unreasonably trying to cut dad out of the kids' lives, that's seen as a form of abuse to the children as well. And so the court can make a decision that the kids should live with dad most of the time because mum's such a negative influence on the kids. But those cases are rare. Yeah, it's unusual for the children not to be living primarily with the mum, or at least equal time.
We've just got to take a quick break in a minute, but I'm just going to ask you one other thing. Do you find that most cases... Is it more often that mum and dad still get along, or is it more often, in your experience... Or is it more often where you've got warring parties?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I'd say it's probably a mix of both. Often the ones that sort it out and get on really well don't necessarily come into our offices. They can sort out the arrangements between them and it works.
So we
get the tough ones. But at the same time, part of our role is to try and help educate parents that, you know, the best thing for them to do is focus on the kids. And if they expose the kids to conflict, they're really hurting the children. And so we try to... and if both parties get family lawyers, hopefully they'd be told the same sort of thing, and they might come in warring and wanting to, you know, tear the kids apart, but hopefully if they get good advice they can refocus what's important and try and work things out, but sometimes you can't do that.
All right, I've just got to take a quick break and be back with more.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And I've got Andrew and Matthew from Hutchison Legal with me, and we talk all things, well, mainly family law. And if you've got any questions on family law, give us a quick ring, 59-615-991. Can't talk about a case, but we can find out a bit about the law. Now, Andrew, you were saying that the children's rights are already, are the ones that are the of the paramount. How does a judge know, like a two-year-old probably can't tell you anything, but say a four-year-old, five-year-old, six-year-old, like does a judge take them by themselves? I mean, you've got mum and dad looking at them. We're talking about now in the family court, really. You've got mum and dad both staring them down, and I can imagine a child being very not knowing what to do. They don't want to sort of have a go at mum and dad. So does a judge take them off in a room by themselves, or is it all done together, or how does that work?
Yeah, so in terms of the children's rights, they don't have the right necessarily to get what they want, so it depends on the age of the child. Certainly their wishes have to be taken into account, and to do that, and I think that's what you're asking, is so the judge doesn't directly talk to the children, but the court will appoint an independent professional, so someone it might be a child psychologist or someone with a background in social sciences that will meet with the children if they're old enough to give a view, and they'll talk to the child, and they'll try to work out, dig beneath the surface as to why the child might be saying what they're saying. Sometimes a child might say, I hate mum, love dad. And then when they're asked, oh, why is that? They might say, I don't know, or I was told to say that. Or they might say, I get ice cream every night or something like that. So the court or the independent expert has to try and weigh up not just what they're saying, but what might be influencing them. And then come up with some recommendations about what's going to be best for that child. The older they are, the more weight that has to be given to their views. If you've got a 14-year-old that says, I can't stand living with mum, I want to go with dad, well, there's not a whole lot the court could probably do to interfere with that. Maybe not quite 14, but certainly 16, 17. Yep. If you've got a 5-year-old that says, I like mum because she gives me cake for dinner every night or whatever, then it's not as relevant. Yeah.
And I was going to ask you that at a different age. So, at what age would the person, the independent person, really take notice of a mum? I mean, a 5-year-old can hate mum today and love her in 3 hours' time, or vice versa with dad.
Yeah, that's right.
So, at what age what they think really become, set in concrete, where the judge would say, well, no, I believe. This is going to have to happen.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one because sometimes people make the assumption that the child gets to decide, and if they don't want to go, they don't have to go. Certainly, 17-year-old, it'll be a rare case where the court interferes with what a 17-year-old wants to do, even 16. If the child's mature enough and they're expressing their views and they've got good reasons for feeling the way they do, then most of the time the court will follow what they want. If you get an 11-year-old and, the orders say that they've got to go to dad's for the weekend and mum drops them off or tries to drop them off and the kid says, I don't want to go, well, the mother is expected to make the child comply. I mean, often our children don't want to do what we tell them to do, but it's our job as parents to, they don't want to clean their room, but we can convince them to do that. So in a similar way, the courts take that view with children, that if one child is, 10 years old, 11 years old, says they don't want to go, well, the other parent's expected to get the child to go.
That was going to be my next question. But at what age would it be where they, I don't want to take sides on this, so either mum or dad rocks up with a child to the other parent. Well, it's not normally at a house, is it? I mean, it's very rare where they take them to the other person's house. Usually they meet at Macca's, don't they? I've seen them do it.
It's often at a neutral location. But if the parents get along well, house to house is often a good way to do it. But, it's probably not the most common.
The ones I've seen them, you've normally been at Macca's and places like that.
Yeah.
So at what stage, at what age, if a mum turns up or a dad turns up with Junior said, I'm not getting out of the car. I am just not going to get out of the car. So mum goes around, she opens the door, she tries to pull the person out, but you've got to, we can't have violence here. So all of a sudden, at what stage can that parent say, well, I just give up.
Yeah. So it's got to be. It's got to be. The court orders have to be practical, and they have to be able to be enforced. So, you know, if you've got a relatively modest sized mum, and you've got a towering 16-year-old that says, "I'm not getting out of the car, make me," and the mum literally can't. Well, she's not going to be expected to. But if you've got a 10-year-old that's saying, "No, I'm not going," then the parent would be expected to be able to force them to do that. So not with using violence, but just using, you're the parent, you get them to do the dishes or do whatever. And often, if the child doesn't want to go, the question is, well, why is that? And it would depend on the reasons. If the child's saying they don't want to go because they've been abused or the dad's new partner's violent or whatever, then that's got to be assessed. But if the child doesn't have a good reason for it, then the other parent would be expected to force them to go, and not just force, but encourage them to go as well. It's really important for children to know that mum loves dad and dad loves mum, even if they're not living together anymore. Because when one parent actively disencourages a child from spending time with the other parent or bad mouths the other parent, the child is actually feeling like it's a personal attack on them, because that's their identity. And there's nothing worse than one parent bad mouthing the other in front of the kids.
But let's also be fair, kids know how to play the game, don't they?
Absolutely. They do.
Mum and dad, don't they?
They do. And I often say to clients when they come in and say, "Oh, the child said this and this is what happened at dad's house or mum's house," and I say, "You've got to understand, you've got this child caught in the middle. They're telling you what they think you want to hear. They know that you love it when the other parent's done the wrong thing or whatever. You can't always believe it. It's not their fault necessarily. The kids are just caught in the middle." But you're exactly right, Alan. They always say things from their own perspective, and sometimes they'll tell mum one thing and they'll tell dad the exact opposite because they're just trying to keep the peace, or they're trying to be opportunistic and play the parents.
I'm not saying, but some of them know that. Even in a loving relationship, where mum and dad are together and there's no argument, very well they ask dad something. If they get a no, then they go to mum.
That's right, yeah. And that problem is magnified when they're separated. That's exactly right. And that's why it's so important for mum and dad to be on the same page. And if the child says something, the best thing is the parents can call each other and say, "Did you really say this? Or is this really what's happening?" And make sure they're on a united front so the kids don't take advantage, because, that can be a big problem.
All right, we're just going to take another quick break.
Say love, it is a river that drowns the tender reed. Some say love, it is a razor that leaves your soul.
Learns to Great fun. It's just got to be Yarra Valley FM 99.1.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Andrew, it's up. Well, we haven't been talking about a perfect world because, unfortunately, when there's a breakup, people say and do a whole lot of things that maybe they wouldn't normally do. But what happens if a father wants, or a mother decides that she doesn't want the ex-husband to see the children at all, so she makes accusations that certain things are happening that shouldn't be happening? What happens in a case like that?
Yeah, it's a real tricky one because the priority is the well-being of the children. As soon as someone makes allegations that the children are unsafe, the court's going to take that seriously. So to start with, it can make it very hard. There might be, the parent who's had the accusations made against them might have to do a period of supervised time. There might have to be psychological assessments, drug screens, things like that, depending on what the allegations are. And it can take time to really jump through the hoops to prove that the kids are safe. If in the long run it turns out that one parent made up allegations, then that can be seen as a form of abuse to the children as well. So in the long run it can really hurt the parent that's made the allegations if they've, if the children have missed out unreasonably. But it can take it's a big process to go through to try and, prove one's innocence, so to speak, in order to make sure the children are safe.
Well, particularly in a lot of these cases, what happens is happening behind closed doors too, isn't it?
That's exactly right, yeah. Often the only witnesses to these allegations are the parties themselves, and it's up to a judge to try and work out who they think's telling the truth. And sometimes there can be independent evidence to try and prove. Like if the allegations are drug use, it's not hard to prove with some drug tests whether there is a history of drug use or a pattern of drug use. Mental health, it's not hard to get a psychological assessment and things like that. So depending on the allegations, a lot of them can be proven to be true or false. The hardest one's family violence, but again, the children's own wishes can play a part in that. If mum might make whatever allegations about dad, but if the kids are happy and they're safe and they're comfortable, then, it might not be too much of a problem.
All right, we'll take another quick break and we'll be back with more.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live. This ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry. Say, live and let die. Live and let die. We'll be right back.
live and let die.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And we always like to send your way with some questions from our audience, and I've tried to, of late to wait until I got two or three on the same theme so that we can delve into a bit more. Now, this one's a fairly, I don't say sad, but it's certainly we're getting down there, and we're talking about the sex register. A criminal goes to court, he's committed, or he or she has committed a sex crime. There's been a few of late, which I think is what's brought this question up. So there is a couple of things we want to know. First of all, a few things. First of all, how does the judge decide the length that the person's on the sex register? Because some people seem to go on it for life, some are on it for 5 years, some are on it for 10 years. So we want to know not how he does it, but what he has to take into account to decide what the length of the time is. It is. What sort of person gets onto the sex register? Now, I'm not talking about the personality, we're talking about what do they have to do to get it. You know, is it only really serious sex cases or is it something else? And if he will say that he says that the person's on the sex register for 5 years, do they automatically come off at the end of the 5 years? Do they have to apply to come off it? And the other thing is, what is this sex register? Because Joe Blow can't ever, because there's been a lot of talk about people wanting the sex register available to Mr. and Mrs. Average, don't they? So they know, and I know the governments are fighting against that because they're afraid of vigilantes. Although I believe in some states in Australia, you can go along and see the register. So who has the register? Is it the police? Is it the courts? Under what conditions do they look at that register? Is it because a person's going to be has committed a crime, so do they go and look at the sex register to see if that person's ever been in it? And who can see it? Like, are the police got access to it? Is it only judges? Is it only court officials? So if you could just have a look at that whole sex register as to how, why, and all that sort of stuff, that'd be terrific.
Yeah, great questions.
So it's we've put a few together there, and we'll find out next month. Someone will have the choice job of having to come and sort it out. All right, Andrew, seeing you're the family law expert, we want to use you while you're here. What sort of options are available to warring parents? Is it a case of they come to you and you say to them, well, this is what I think you should do, and they say, well, that's it, we're off to court? I mean, well, put it this way. First of all, out of the cases you see each year, how many would go to court? And if they came to you today, and obviously, well, are you allowed to talk to both sides, or are you only allowed to take on one side and you have to go through another solicitor? And what options can you offer?
Yeah, no, great questions. Most cases don't go to court, which is good news. There's a big push for people to sort things out. And in fact, in a parenting case, you have to try some sort of mediation before you're allowed to bring it to court anyway. So you need a certificate to say you've given that a good go. So most cases do resolve outside of court. It's always helpful for people to get legal advice at an early stage, because then if both people are getting advice, they're going to hear the same thing and they're more likely to be able to sort things out. There's lots of mediation services. There's people can negotiate with lawyers, without lawyers. There's a whole lot of different avenues for people to try and come to an agreement. And even if it gets to court, it's only a very small percentage that go all the way to a judge making a decision.
Is it?
Yeah, I would say it'd be probably less than 5%.
So where did how are they resolved at the court?
Through the court process. So the people there might be some expert reports prepared at an early stage that help people to sort of reassess their case and come to an agreement. The court will require people to undertake some sort of dispute resolution process. So a lot of cases resolve with the help of a court registrar or a mediator. A lot of the time those expert reports will help people to come to an agreement. So, and because it's such a, if someone starts a case in court, they might not get a judgment from a judge for 18 months, 2 years. So there's a huge incentive for people to try and sort it out.
I was going to ask you that, how long, like if you had a case today that you said, I just can't solve this, so it could take 18 months to go through the court. So what happens during those 18 months, first of all at the court, but if you've got a warring partners and one doesn't want to let the other one have the children, what happens for those 18 months?
So there can be a whole lot of interim hearings and interim stages. So the court will want to try and get things on track to start with. It might be some sort of interim arrangement, but it really depends on what the allegations are, why, you know, what's the problem, and that will determine what path it takes in court. But there may be a whole lot of steps along the way to try and get things in place on an interim basis until, you know, a final decision can be made.
What have you, in your experience, we're talking about your experience now, have you had any case where somebody's come to you along and just refused to negotiate, just said, this is what I want, that's it?
Yeah, I've certainly had clients come in with that attitude, but they don't have it for very long. Part of my job is to help them realise that if they take that approach, the judge won't like them, and you know they need to be focusing on the kids, and it's not in their interest to take that view. And so usually clients will take that advice and we can try and sort things out. You know, part of what I often say to clients is, you know, you're paying me to give you advice. If you don't take the advice, you might as well...
You're
wasting your money. That's right.
That's true, actually. Bad way of putting it.
So usually, and I often say to clients, the best thing that can happen is that the other, you know, their ex goes and gets a good family lawyer as well, because then we'll be able to sort it out. And to answer your question before, can one lawyer see both parties? Unfortunately not, because there's always a conflict there that what's good for one is not going to be as good for the other. But if both people get their own advice, then there's usually a middle ground that's not too unreasonable for both of them.
So a lot of your work, if the stuff before it goes to court, would be negotiating. Like you'd be saying, well, my client wants this, and the other client says that. So then you'd be talking through your client, or with your client, but you'd be negotiating client.
That's right. Yeah.
Solicitor.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, and we solve a lot of cases that way because the lawyers know what's going to happen if it goes to court, so we can save a lot of time and money and heartache if we just sort of cut to the chase and put something in place that everyone can live with.
Andrew, it's a bit unfair, and I don't want to know any much about it. What would be the worst case you've ever had without naming anyone or without...
Yeah, the worst ones are the ones where there's allegations that a child's been abused by a parent. They're the worst cases. I've acted for clients where they've been completely innocent, but there've been allegations made against them, and I've been acting for clients where they've made allegations, and whatever side of that you're on, it's a sad situation, and there's often... it's hard to find a good way forward.
Is it?
Yeah, because there's often not any middle ground. It's hard to settle those cases where one parent's saying the other one's abuse the children. The best scenario there, and I've had a few cases where, you know, the allegations have been looked at forensically, we've had some experts involved, and the evidence seems to suggest that the abuse didn't occur, and the parties have been able to accept that and then resolve it. But where the allegations are maintained, those are the cases that do go all the way to a judge making a decision.
Let me just ask you too, if the allegation is abuse against mum or dad, either way, not the child, does that have any influence on the outcome?
Yeah, the court has to then assess what's the risk to the child. So there's lots of cases where the parties themselves have had family violence, and sometimes it's mutual, it goes both ways. Yep. As long as the children aren't at risk to that, so it would have to, it would depend on what sort of abuse has occurred, whether there's been any threats to the children, whether the, you know, sometimes the hard ones are where one parent has threatened to kill the children to the other, so that's not a threat directly to the children, but obviously it's about them, and it's got to be taken seriously. But there's lots of cases where there's been sadly violence between the parents, but it doesn't mean the children should necessarily miss out on having a relationship with one or both of the parents.
In your job, have you ever felt threatened yourself because your client didn't get what they thought they should get?
I'm not so much threatened by my own clients. I've certainly had threats from the other side where I've been threatened that I'll be killed along with everybody else and things like that. But you sort of try not to take too much notice of it. It's just part and parcel of the job. And there's lots of unhappy people say sad, you know, say things that you hope they don't really mean.
Right on the spur of the moment. Yeah. That's very sad, though, isn't it?
It is.
Because if a relationship breaks down, then that's not okay. But I mean, it still shouldn't be where a third party like yourself starts getting threatened with being killed or the other partner either, is there?
No, that's right. No, it's very sad. And you just hope that those people can get the help they need to work through it. It's always tricky when a relationship breaks down. There's, you know, people hurt all around, and you just hope they can find a way to deal with it.
What's your biggest problem in relationship breaks down? Alcohol, drugs, or abuse, or what's the biggest one?
Yeah, I think the biggest would have to be drugs and alcohol. I think alcohol is a massive problem, and it's often overlooked because it's so easy to get. It's not illegal, but it's a massive problem. And then obviously drugs, illicit substances, because parents just, it's so hard to break the addiction. I've had, if there's any incentive for a client to try and get off the drugs or alcohol, it's to, you know, not lose your children. But I've certainly acted for parents where they haven't been able to do that and they've lost their children because of it. So substance abuse is terrible, yeah.
Do they then blame the system, or can people then see that they've done it to themselves?
Yeah, I think sometimes people, when they're substance affected like that, they're not the most rational people, so it depends sort of what day you get them on. But I think there is some sense of understanding that there's choices and consequences, and I always try to give people hope that if they can clean up their act and then, you know, have a good period, a good track record, they can come back. And there's some of the best cases I've acted for people where they've admitted they've done the wrong thing, they've gone away, they've cleaned up their act, they've been clean for a couple of years, and then they try to reach out to the kids and form that relationship. And they're really some really rewarding cases where you see someone that's turned their life around. And
so it's not all downhill.
Not all downhill, that's right. There's always hope.
Gentlemen, I've got to go. Thank you for your time yet again. We always enjoy our legal hour every second Wednesday of the month between 1 and 2. So we'll look forward to hearing someone from your place along with the answer to the question for us next month.
Great. Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys.